French people seem to feel toward their system. Do you think, you know, if one's realistic about it today, that Sarkozy is much less sort of reviled and hated in France than the current serving president, Monsieur Macron?
Indeed, he is. Yeah, no, it's a very odd time in French politics, indeed. And I think ordinary French people have got many, many other preoccupations apart from the fate of the man who was president 20 years ago.
Yeah, indeed. Well, listen, Peter, it's been great to have you on. I am now waiting, looking at a TV screen. I want to see pictures of him walking out of jail, which I guess is supposed to happen later today. We'll see just how high that head is being held. But thank you very, very much indeed for joining me on The Times at One. That is pretty much it from me for this hour. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Very soon, I'm going to be handing over to Fee and Rosie, who are standing by. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you tomorrow.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Stephen, thank you. Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. You are listening to Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, in for Jane Garvey this week here on Times Radio.
And coming up over the next 2 hours, we're going to talk to former head of Channel 4 News, Dorothy Byrne, about the resignations from the BBC. As the issues of impartiality and free speech loom large, we're going to ask whether Elon Musk's Grokopedia is a legitimate rival to Wikipedia, or as he calls it, Wokopedia. Can we all see what he's done there? And does the pipeline to a successful career begin with teenage binge drinking? One study has connected the two things, and it's a Monday, so we'll be chatting books with Laura Hackett and money with Adam Shaw.
But first, let's get the very latest news now with Howard Bentham.
Thank you. Good afternoon. President Donald Trump has sent a letter to the BBC threatening legal action. The BBC has confirmed it has received the letter and will respond in due course. Earlier, BBC chair Samir Shah issued a written statement apologising for an error of judgment in how a Panorama documentary edited a speech by the US president. The head of BBC News, Deborah Turness, who's resigned alongside the director general, Tim Davey, has denied there's institutional bias at the broadcaster.
Of course our journalists aren't corrupt. Our journalists are hard-working people who strive for impartiality, and I will stand by their journalism.
Is there institutional bias at the BBC?
There is no institutional bias. Mistakes are made, but there's no institutional bias.
But why weren't the mistakes dealt with on Trump, on anti-Semitism, on women's rights?
I'm sure that story will emerge, but for now, I'm going to go and see our team.
Do you think the board acted against you? Do you think the board acted against you?
This way, Deborah.
We're going in. Thank you.
Ben Bradshaw is a former BBC News correspondent and also Culture Secretary in the previous Labour government. He told Times Radio the BBC is worth fighting for.
Recognise the value and importance of having fair, objective and impartial news, which almost uniquely the BBC and other broadcasters in the UK, thanks to the regulatory system we have in contrast to other countries, we have that. But if we lose that, we end up like America, where we're so polarised, no one's listening to each other, where there's no common accepted truth. We still have that in this country just about, and we need to defend it.
Another migrant removed to France under the government's one-in, one-out deal has returned to the UK. The Home Office says the man will be sent back as quickly as possible. The International Olympic Committee is set to announce a ban on transgender women in female competition early next year after a science-based review of evidence about the permanent physical advantages of being born male. The IOC's guidance to Olympic sports has until now been that transgender women can compete with reduced testosterone levels, but leaves it up to individual sports to decide. That's now set to change under its new president, Kirsty Coventry, who's promised to protect the female category. The Times sports editor, Tom Clark, says there are still a few hoops to jump through.
That there's still, you know, the legal ramifications of this. They've got to make sure that this is watertight from that point of view. And it's we believe that they won't announce this until the new year. So, you know, we're in November now. There'll be a reaction to this and subsequent discussions, I'm sure. So, as you say, it's been discussed for a long time. And I think it's probably the most significant thing, as I say, was Kirsty Coventry's appointment as the new president of the IOC.
Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy will be released from prison and placed under judicial supervision. It's less than 3 weeks since he started serving a five-year sentence for criminal conspiracy. Former Tesco boss Sir Dave Lewis has been named as the new chief executive of Guinness maker Diageo. He'll start the position next year on an annual salary of £1.5 million. And the Prince of Wales has said that not allowing his 12-year-old son, Prince George, to have a mobile phone has become a little bit of a tense issue. The heir to the throne has been speaking about how he and Kate discuss challenges they face as a family with their children. The royal couple also decided to tell their children everything about Kate's cancer diagnosis. Don't forget, you can set the Times News briefing as your news service on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Now, just to be crystal clear, because facts are very important to us here at Times Radio, Jane Garvey is off the show this week. It is Rosie Wright sitting in for Jane Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Welcome to the afternoon show. See, no edits at all. You make up your mind using all of the facts we present before you, and we take your feedback in the moment. We're 0333 003 2353. This is how we look this afternoon. We will talk about a story in the Times today claiming that those who indulge in binge drinking early on in their career years end up being more successful than those who stop at one lager top and leave before anybody opens up the photocopier at the Christmas party. Can this really be true? We're also going to talk about dynamic pricing coming to the Royal Opera House, which might mean that prices for very sought-after events will go through what is already considered by many to be a high elitist roof. We're going to ask, what is Grokopedia and why would you want to use it? And we will talk about the BBC, and we'll do that with Dorothy Byrne, who is a media maven. She has been the head of news and current affairs at Channel 4. She is a fellow of the Royal Television Society, winner of numerous journalistic awards, and she always casts a very wise eye across the horizon of television and journalism. So we will talk to her after 3 o'clock today. We know that many of you have thoughts about what's happened at the BBC, and we would love to hear those. I know we've been talking about the story all across the network since the late hours of Sunday evening, but do take the time to let us know your opinions if you would like to. We will scatter them throughout the programme whilst we talk about other things. Oh, and a fascinating story in about 10 minutes time where we delve inside the mind of a 16-year-old. Steady yourselves against something firm. Rosie, what is in the top three in the newspaper stories today?
Yeah, let's take a flick through. So it's 6 minutes past two, what you are reading. Number three, Ghislaine Maxwell raves about life in a minimum security prison is the headline. This is, of course, the 63-year-old associate of Jeffrey Epstein who was moved to federal prison Camp Byron in Texas days after meeting with Trump's deputy attorney general. The second most story is an interview with Nick Mohammed saying, "I'll never do a show like Celebrity Traitors again." The Faithful and how he got it really spectacularly wrong just in those final few moments. But the most read piece on the Times website this afternoon is, "Forget Dubai, Britons are moving here to cut tax bills." A person quoted in the piece says, "They drive on the same side of the road, there are red post boxes, HSBC's on the corner, and they have Marks and Spencer. Where are they talking about?"
Well, you'll just have to read it to find out. You can go to thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can do that at thetimes.com/subscribe. And if you are a digital subscriber, it's not just today's articles you can read. You can also access the full archive online, including the in-depth interviews from the weekend's papers. And over the last couple of days, for instance, we've had superb interviews with Gordon Ramsay and Sir Alan Bates. If you want to read those, plus all of the features from the Saturday and Sunday Times, just head to our website or app and check them out.
Let's kick off with the politics, shall we? Lots for us to get into in the next 10 minutes or so. First of all, the US president is threatening to sue the BBC over the editing of that clip that was in the Panorama programme. The BBC's chairman has this lunchtime apologised for the editing. That programme was the final scandal for both the corporation's Director General Tim Davey and its news chief, Deborah Turness. They've both resigned. Oliver Wright is the Times Whitehall editor and joins us now. Ollie, good afternoon.
Hello.
This latest apology, then, from the BBC, what have they said and what problem does it actually solve?
It's good questions. I mean, effectively, you've had a letter by the chair of the BBC to the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, at which he very plainly admits that mistakes were made, particularly in relation to that Panorama programme that you talked about earlier. But he goes in some depth to try and explain to the committee exactly how the BBC looked at each of these instances and what they did and when they did it. And what he rejects utterly is this idea that the BBC doesn't take these kind of complaints seriously. He says, you know, we looked at all these complaints. We've made changes to the way in which we do things. We look at the systems. We look at the individual complaints. And he says, you know, I don't believe that the BBC is biased. But, you know, clearly that isn't going to silence his or the BBC's critics.
Well, absolutely. And now we hear from the US president this threat to sue the BBC. How yep. seriously is that threat going to be taken? Is it going to cause some sort of, you know, upset at Number 10?
I think Number 10 will be trying to keep as far out of it as they possibly can. I think it will concern the BBC. I don't know in which jurisdiction Trump is threatening, and whether indeed he's got lawyers on board, or whether it's just sort of it's sort of noises off. Trump has done this kind of thing in the past to varying degrees of effect, but clearly it just sort of amplifies the story. And yeah, really, it was the statement by Trump on Sunday and the previous statement by his spokesman on Friday that really sort of brought a lot of this stuff to its head.
You say Number 10 want to sort of steer clear. This story, though, is so intertwined with politics. And I think Number 10 actually might be pleased that the Chancellor is not on the front pages. Instead, it's these other individuals. But there's been a storm of criticism from the right and the left. What kind of questions do you think it throws up about the future of the BBC and also, of course, the licence fee?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one thing which is worth saying is why do they care so much? And the reason why politicians of all ilks care so much is because of the sort of, you know, the dominant feature of BBC in national life. If you look where people, you know, get their news, most people, you know, as well as reading newspapers, as well as, you know, listening to commercial radio, they do, you know, they are, a lot of what they know about the world around them comes from the BBC. And therefore, it's a huge focus for all politicians. When they hear something or see something they don't like on the BBC, they want to sort of turn it around. They feel very passionately about it and very personally about it, which is why this thing matters. And as you say, they get attacked by politicians both on the left and the right. And if you talk to people in the BBC, that will say, well, maybe we're doing something right. But that's not necessarily the way the politicians see it.
Absolutely. I mean, capitalising on this current crisis is Nigel Farage. He was giving a press conference early and had this to say.
The BBC has been institutionally biased for decades. People talk about election interference. What the BBC did was election interference.
I mean, Ollie, is Nigel Farage going to try and benefit from this?
Of course. But I mean, I should just say, just to the previous point, the Liberal Democrats have got a campaign going saying that the BBC is giving far too much coverage to Nigel Farage and reform, and that they're biased in favour of reform. So really they can't win. But no, Farage will see this as something that, you know, he can make capital out of. And, you know, he may have a point. For a long time, people have said that, you know, the BBC was not sufficiently alive to concerns of people who didn't share their kind of sort of metropolitan elite view of the world. And I think the BBC has tried to respond to that. You know, you also saw the sort of founding of GB News, which was meant to sort of fill that gap in the market. And I think Farage will certainly sense an opportunity here to use it as a sort of political campaigning tool as much as anything else.
Yeah, I think that sentiment really started to grow really in around the lockdowns, didn't it? Which is what Nigel Farage has made that point many times. Shall we pivot to what he was supposed to be talking about before he then seized the opportunity to bash the BBC somewhat? He said Reform UK is going to be the party of small business. What is the pitch and how much do you think it's needed?
So his argument is fundamentally that politicians only listen to the interests of big business, that they have a seat at the table, but actually the sort of vast majority of the business community in the UK don't run large businesses. They run small businesses that might employ just a handful of people or 50 or 70 people. And he says that, you know, really successive governments have not taken their interests seriously enough. He particularly talks about regulation and the sort of burden on regulation on businesses. And he's making a sort of direct appeal to them. He's saying, come and join Reform. We will be your voice. We're ahead in the polls. And you can actually sort of help set our agenda. And it's quite a smart pitch, because actually politicians have often neglected sort of smaller sized businesses, mainly partly because it's harder to sort of deal with so many different types of businesses. It's easier to talk to the sort of representatives of the of big companies rather than small companies. And so, you know, Farage is trying to differentiate Reform, as it were, and making it the party of small business, which fits in with its sort of broader brand.
Absolutely. I mean, all those businesses, small, large, and also all households, are preparing, really, or bracing, I should say, for Rachel Reeves' budget, which we know is going to be sort of, I think, enormously consequential. The smart money at this point, Ollie, is that tax rises are happening, but in which form, that seems to be the bit where there's the question mark.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, we've heard a lot of signalling in the last few weeks from both Downing Street and the Treasury that, you know, a rise in income tax is on the cards. Now, the question is that a straightforward rise in income tax, say one pence on the basic rate of income tax, or do they try and do something slightly cleverer? So there's one idea during the rounds, which is that they might put up income tax by two pence and at the same time cut national insurance for lower paid workers by two pence. Now, this would allow Reeves to stand up there and say, I am protecting working people, while at the same time clobbering pensioners, because the point about income tax is that income tax is paid on all sources of income, whereas national insurance is only paid by people in work. So that is one of the ideas. I still think it's fair to say that exactly what is in the budget is not completely nailed down. We've got the sort of latest round with the OBR today, and their sort of final economic predictions ahead of the budget. So decisions are going to be made in the coming days, but she's still got a bit of wriggle room. And I think, you know, the question of exactly what to do on income tax is still a live debate in government.
Underlying that debate, do you identify, Ollie, a sort of fundamental philosophy that's underpinning all the decisions? Or is this sort of kind of an emergency, you know, use this finger to plug that gap and do elsewhere somewhere here as well?
Well, the question is really what came first. Yeah, did they start with a philosophy, or did they start with plug the back gap and then create a philosophy to try and justify plugging the gap? Certainly, if you talk to them, they would say yes, there is a philosophy, and the philosophy is we are a party which will not return to austerity, and there is this choice facing the UK that, you know, there is less money than there was, you know, things which Labour would claim they can't control mean that, you know, there's a shortfall in the amount of money that they need to carry out their plans, and they have to make a choice between, you know, cutting public services or increasing taxes. Yeah. And they say, we make the choice about, you know, public services, putting that first, because they think that's what Labour voters want. So, yeah, that's their philosophy, as it were.
The final thing I want to talk to you about, Ollie, while you're here, sorting out the economy, one clearly large looming problem. The other has been that other election promise to smash the gangs. We've heard today, in terms of channel crossings, that now a second migrant who had been deported has come back over in a small boat. I mean, this is a problem that so far does not have a permanent solution.
No, it doesn't. And that's sort of quite good gag, one in, one out, and one back again. Now you've got one in, one out, and two back again. This was, you know, as everyone remembers, this was one of the signature pledges of Labour. They would smash the gang, stop the boats, and, you know, lo and behold, they found in government that is a huge deal more difficult than it is in a sort of easy electioneering slogan. And that would be true of whatever party was in power. you know, they have done quite a lot. Some of it has been more effective than others, or may prove to be more effective than others. But the truth is, you know, it's going in the wrong direction. And Starmer knows that, yeah, he has a bit of time, but, you know, he needs to show at the time of the next election that really this is a problem that has been got under control. And I don't think they're anywhere near that yet.
I have to say, I think I agree. Oliver, thank you very much. Thanks. Oliver Wright, the Whitehall editor at The Times, the sort of whistle-stop tour of all the political developments today, of which there have been many.
Yes, it was a Rolodex of news. Thank you very much indeed for all of your thoughts and texts so far. We remain 87222 if you want to just use a messaging service. You've got to start your message with the word Times, otherwise it could go anywhere in the building, or we're 0333 003 2353 on the WhatsApp. Dominic says, unfortunately, Trump's behaviour seems to reinforce the idea that bullying gets you what you want. It's disgraceful. But Paul in Edinburgh says, good afternoon. The BBC allowed their disdain of Trump to affect their editorial output, and it was very stupid and irresponsible of them. If they really wanted to show Trump up, they had plenty of material without doctoring a speech. And this one comes in from Neil, who says, my view on the BBC is that you're all being self-indulgent in giving it so much coverage because you work in the media and many of you have worked for the BBC or have friends that work there. I think you're making it much bigger than most of us care about, given all of the issues in the world that you could be discussing. Come on, Times Radio, please get back to your usual great news agenda. Well, Neil, I give you a small salute and tell you that next we're going to talk about something completely different. Filthy rich, teenage binge drinker, why those two things might be connected. It's coming up to 20 past two. Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Global events.
How difficult is it for culture in Ukraine to thrive when the country's under assault?
Breaking news.
A crisis that has spiraled into the Middle East as competition for resources intensifies.
Reactive analysis.
We'll consider what's at stake for both leaders and our national politics.
From the world's best journalists.
Two people with different perspectives tell us what they think about today's events.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Those who are curious feel an urge to travel, to explore the world. At Viking, we create voyages for the thinking person because travel enriches the mind and connects cultures in meaningful ways. With small, modern, all-veranda ocean ships that were designed to bring you closer to the destination, discover the world's iconic cities and quaint villages. Exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms, the experts in design and installation. From plumbing and tiling to electrical work, the Wix Bathroom Installation Service can take care of everything. Start your journey today by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, Neil, forgive me, so I'm just going to squeeze in a tiny message about the BBC. It comes in from Josh, who says, it seems ironic I've heard more of a robust defence on the BBC on Times Radio today than anything I've seen or heard on the BBC, which in itself explains much of the decline of the BBC.
Now, a new Norwegian study has found a surprising link between heavy drinking in youth and later career success. Experts tie this to the fact that alcohol may function as a social lubricant that smooths career paths and eases the awkwardness of networking. But excessive drinking also has negative impacts on health, and it really isn't generally seen as a fast track to wealth. Let's talk about this with UCL researcher and lead author Dr. Melissa Oldham. Dr. Oldham, I think many people on hearing the story today or reading the story today have been a bit surprised that you would want to give any kind of credence to very heavy drinking by saying that there's something further down the line that you will get as a kind of result from it.
Hi, yeah. So I wasn't the lead author on this one, actually. I was not involved in the study itself. And I think I would tend to agree with you. So I think probably what is going on in this study, which saw this link between kind of regular heavy drinking in their late teens and kind of later education and income, is actually more due to kind of advantage and the backgrounds that people are coming from. So we know that people from more advantaged backgrounds tend to go on to a higher level of education and earn more money. And we also know that people from more advantaged backgrounds tend to drink more alcohol than those from less advantaged backgrounds. So I think probably what's happening here is that together these findings are suggesting that kind of any apparent benefit of youthful binge drinking is probably more down to privilege and social context, not a kind of positive causal effect of alcohol.
Sure. Our apologies for making you the lead author on this research.
Okay,
No, fair enough. And good to point it out right at the beginning. But I suppose as well that, you know, there must be research that you can do that would suggest that very heavy drinking in your early years has such negative impacts on health that actually you struggle to get on in your work at all.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge amount of evidence now which shows that there's a dose response relationship between alcohol and harm. So the more that people drink, the more likely they are to experience a wide range of harms. And that's kind of physical long-term health conditions such as liver cancer and liver disease. But it's also kind of shorter term harms as well. So things like headaches, hangovers, impact on anxiety and depression and mental health. We have this strong causal evidence. So I don't think that anybody would suggest that people drink more in order to do better at work.
Yeah, it is definitely true, though, that there is a drinking culture that has existed in many workplaces and in many professions. And it is an absolute truth that if you're part of that club, you probably have access to better networking. And at a time at which people are probably a bit more vulnerable, letting their guard down, making promises, bonding over something, I mean, that has existed throughout time, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And it's something that people speak about. I think there's something inherent in British culture in particular that we kind of centre alcohol in so many cultural events and social events. So in terms of weddings, toasts and wetting the baby's head when there's a, you know, christenings, Christmas do's, all these kind of things. And I think that definitely filters across into workspaces and has traditionally, like you say, a lot of networking and kind of socialising opportunities are done in the pub. But I do think that's something that we're seeing slight changes in. So we had some focus groups recently at UCL, and particularly among younger drinkers, they kind of talked about this as being quite harmful to modern multicultural Britain, because increasingly amongst young people, they are drinking less alcohol, and those that do are drinking, you know, less when they do drink. So I think potentially we're starting to see a little bit of a move away from that kind of central role of alcohol in all social events.
Yeah, and I would put my hands up to feeling the pressure to be part of a drinking culture when I was much younger. And I think particularly being a young woman in a very male-dominated newsroom and always male-dominated radio stations, being able to go to the pub with everybody, I felt was something that if I didn't do it, I wouldn't be as firmly part of the workplace as I wanted to be. And I'm really hoping that that isn't the case, particularly for young women these days. It's interesting, this is a Norwegian study. Do you think that they are travelling in the same direction as us in terms of equality and drinking? I've always thought that Norway might be ahead of us in terms of equality and drinking.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that so the declines that we're seeing in terms of younger people's consumption of alcohol do seem to be taking a place over a wide range of high-income countries. I couldn't speak to Norway specifically, but it's possible that that is going in the right direction. And I think in terms of gender equality in the workplace, certainly that would kind of be comparable, I would say, to what's happening in the UK.
Did you experience anything similar in the world of academia?
It's a really good question. And I think I definitely feel like in the kind of 10 years that I've been working in this field, I do feel that that has changed a little bit. And possibly that's also to do with kind of, obviously, as you kind of get more senior. But when I was doing my PhD, I think there was definitely a big drinking culture. And I was in a department that a lot of the work was focused on alcohol and different types of addiction. But yeah, you definitely still saw that kind of take place there in terms of those social bonds then kind of forming the basis for potential opportunities. So I can completely sympathize with people. But I think that's something that we're kind of moving away from.
Yep. And presumably, and I don't want to imagine your life and give a false description of it, Dr. Oldham, but, you know, especially if you're on campus, you're in the kind of environment where, you know, the student union is going to have, you know, quite a lot of booze available, there's going to be an opportunity to booze. And actually, looking back, and I hate to bring the BBC into disrepute once more, but I mean, I used to work in buildings where there'd be the BBC club, you know, as part of the building. Effectively, you had a pub on site. I mean, that just seems extraordinary now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you walk through outside work in London, and when I walk home on kind of Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, you do see lots of pubs with lots of people still outside them in suits and presumably with colleagues. So, yeah, I think this is, something that is still happening.
Well, it's very good to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed for that. That is UCL researcher Dr. Melissa Oldham. We'd be interested in hearing any experiences that you have, especially if you are a young person and you're in the kind of workplace where you're still feeling that pressure to go out and drink. And this survey is specifically about that kind of binge drinking that you might be encouraged to do. So it's not just going for one drink after work, it is going drinking after work. And I would love to think that that was something that was in the dim and distant past, but I suspect from what this study has revealed that it is still very much there.
It does feel surprising to read it, though, because you feel as though, particularly with the younger generations, and my youngest sister, I'm the eldest of four girls, is in her early 20s. She's in an office with hardly anyone in there because lots of people are working from home. Budgets are much tighter, so you're not going out and drinking so much. And amongst her generation, actually, they're hardly drinking at all. So you wonder, it has something maybe actually been lost just in terms of the social bonding and the cohesion of getting out together. And then I'm sure probably advancing your career. Will sort of makes this point on the text. He says, it reminds me of those who didn't really smoke, but hung around the office, the smoking room or the shelter so they could advance their careers by cornering the puffing managers and blowing smoke up their ego, says Will. But I can totally see the temptation to join in because you don't want to miss out and, you know, lose track of the office politics and not be involved.
Yeah. Oh, no, totally. The smoking room. Oh, dear Lord. That's a place that nobody should ever go back to, not even in their imagination, actually. Ever wonder what could possibly be going on in the mind of a 16-year-old? That's where we're going to go after the very latest news with Howard Bentham.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has sent a letter to the BBC threatening legal action following uproar over the editing of a speech by the US president in a Panorama documentary. Critics said the edit was misleading and removed a section where Mr. Trump said he wanted supporters to demonstrate peacefully. The BBC have said they will review the letter and respond directly in due course. BBC chairman Samir Shah has apologised to MPs for an error of judgment over the editing of the speech. The corporation's director general and head of news have resigned, but Lib Dem leader Sir Ed Davey suggests the BBC should be forgiven for its mistakes.
It is the one institution that's protecting British values from a full Trump takeover. And as that very precious institution, Liberal Democrats will defend it.
The International Olympic Committee will announce a ban on transgender women in female competition early in 2026 after a review of evidence about the physical advantages of being born male. The IOC's new president, Kirsty Coventry, has promised to protect the female category. Online retailer The Very Group has been taken over by a US private equity firm. The company's confirmed that Washington-based Carlyle, one of its major lenders, has become its controlling shareholder. It had been owned by the Barclay family for more than 20 years. And BA's chief executive Sean Doyle says Heathrow Airport should be expanded without moving the M25. Two proposals are being considered by the government, one of which wouldn't require the motorway to be diverted. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage, and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Nice. Direct Line just sorted me a courtesy van. Well, they're fixing mine after my accident. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like clients paying you on time. All done.
Brilliant. Your invoice is all paid up, left you 5-star reviews. Oh, and a bit extra in there for staying late that time. And I baked this cake for you too.
Nice.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Comprehensive cover required. Courtesy van limited for up to 21 days if your van is written off, stolen, or you use your own repairer. Excludes windscreen claims.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's 2:34 in the studio with you today. It is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, sitting in for Jane Garvey, who will be here next week. But when we are out of the studio, John Pienaar takes over, who's with us now. John, it's been, I'm sure for you as well as a former employee, a strange weekend to see the sort of BBC management implode in the way it did over the weekend. What was it like for you, sort of as the story unravelled yesterday?
I don't know. I think you could have probably heard my groan 100 miles away. You know, they were hearing it in Birmingham. It was echoing around the Isle of Wight. I mean, you see a story like this, and what do I think? I think, like a lot of people who worked at the BBC and actually wish the BBC well, which is, it's a product of being the BBC that you can't please everyone. Mm. And it's actually absurd to think that you should even try to please everyone. It is an impossibility. But why make it so much easier for the people who want to come after you? Like Donald Trump, glorying in that Truth Social tweet earlier on, or people who do want to dismantle the BBC and its funding model, you give yourself such an open goal, and people duly take aim at all of that. And the offending, and it was appalling, the edit of Donald Trump's speech on January the 6th outside Congress, it was an appalling, amateurish, crass, misleading piece of journalism, and it deserves to be given a serious kicking. It doesn't, by the way, alter the fact that Donald Trump did incite an angry mob outside Congress. Donald Trump, he said what we all said. I didn't even see this wretched Panorama programme, let alone the clip. But I did feel I knew a lot about January the 6th before we started talking about it. And I remember the congressional inquiry, which was 1,000 witnesses, hundreds of thousands of papers of evidence, which found that there was indeed incitement to insurrection. Didn't go to court for various political reasons in Washington, but that seems to me to be unarguable.
And that the story now is not actually what happened on January the 6th. No. It's about whether you can trust the BBC.
No, but the point about that journalism is it's got the BBC in a corner on the back foot trying to defend what it does. And look, I was there, as you say, I was there for many, many years, and I lost count of the number of times I was there, you know, concerning stories that I was involved in or was watching, where the BBC and the various endless layers of higher-ups would tie themselves in knots, into pretzels, trying not to appear biased or anything but impartial. And that's never going to change. But now we've got a debate, and I think for lots of reasons the right one, about the future of the BBC, how it needs to do better, what it tries to do when it comes to quality control, and about funding for the BBC, which in my view, which is worth literally nothing. I think the present funding of the BBC, that system doesn't fly. You know, you've got a third of people 16 to 34 don't even use the BBC. I mean, how can you justify pay the licence fee or pay £1,000 fine if that's the way things have moved? I don't think it can. So it's opened up all of that need for higher quality control. And it's opened up a ferocious political argument about the BBC, where it needs to give in some places and hold its ground in others. And I'm going to be talking to a former, well, various, there's a sort of a lineup of BBC higher-ups who you talk to at a time like this. David Ilstein, former producer, executive producer, Roger Mosey, former director of BBC TV News. Also, for good measure, Nicky Morgan is a former Tory culture secretary. So, you know, the conversation is on again. It won't be the last one. Anyone who thinks, Rosie and Fee, that the BBC is going to get into a place where people are happy and it can carry on smoothly on its merry ways, need to give their heads a wobble, because this is not going to stop.
I agree with you wholeheartedly there. But I think what we also have to remember is all of the different arms of the BBC. Today we're talking about BBC News, aren't we? But actually, I can pretty much guarantee in 6 weeks' time there'll be something over in entertainment, there'll be something in sport, there'll be something in the World Service. The idea that one person can be Director General of all of those things, I also think is absurd. Isn't it time we just put that to bed?
I know. I think that's a really interesting argument, Fee. I'm not sure that I actually totally agree with that, by the way. And one person, for example, is the Prime Minister of Great Britain. You know, one person is the President of the United States. There's a case for a single where the buck actually stops. Now, you know,
if I agree with that.
Then do these two individuals agree with each other? But they don't.
But I don't think that you can expect one person to have oversight.
No.
And as the BBC keeps on proving,
yes,
it's a lack of oversight,
yes,
that lets it down.
Yeah. Well, God knows, the dear old BBC has got enough thousands of people to share responsibility.
It certainly has.
That conversation continues then with John a little bit later at 4 o'clock here. My own reflections, Fee, I've worked for the BBC, but for a fraction of the time of you two just in the studio, is the public sometimes think, and you have conversation with them, they say the BBC is so biased, all the editors, and it's as though they imagine there's sort of a conference every day where all the senior editors sit down and say, what's our view on this? And they don't realise how the machine actually works, that the website is not necessarily talking to the programme you've listened on your local radio station that morning, and they're not talking to Panorama or Newsnight. There's not this sort of, you know, round table discussion where they decide the line on everything. It's an awful lot of individuals all making separate decisions every day.
I think that's very true. So when the voice comes on and says it's your BBC, actually what they mean is it's your BBC, your BBC, your BBC, your
exactly,
BBC, someone's
yes,
BBC
yeah,
over there, and we're all trying to be answerable. Your thoughts are absolutely brilliant this afternoon. Jan is just livid. Can't you tell how mad I am at the BBC? For goodness sake, you don't need to distort Trump's speeches. What he says is bad enough, and you do it on Panorama, the flagship documentary I would have expected to stick to the absolute truth above all other programmes. And to do it to Trump, are they stupid? This is very serious. We are 0333 003 2353 this afternoon and every afternoon. Right, it's 20 minutes to 3. What goes on in the mind of a 16-year-old? Younger teenagers will get to vote at the next election. So what and who influences them? Who are the politicians who matter to them? And what does it mean to them that the distinction between life on and off the internet is so thoroughly blurred? The think tank Demos has set out to answer those questions with a survey of more than 700 young people. The duo behind the report are former head teacher and one-time Blair and Starmer strategist, Peter Hyman. Very good afternoon, Peter.
Hi, lovely to be here.
And Shoaib Gomote, a researcher and mentor at the Future Governance Forum. Shoaib, very good afternoon to you too. What does the Future Governance Forum do, just so we can really place you in this discussion?
Well, I wrote this on a secondment from the Future Governance Forum, but the Future Governance Forum focuses on systems of government and improving the kind of structure of government.
Okay, thank you. What were you expecting to find when you went into this? Because I think we've got a pretty certain caricature of what our teenagers are like at the moment.
Yes, and you hear that almost on a daily basis. Everyone's being corrupted by Andrew Tate. They're lurching to the right. They're addicted to pornography. They're out of control, and we see that again and again in the headlines. So we wanted to get underneath those headlines and genuinely listen to young people. So we've done that literally up and down the country. And we think this report will surprise people and be a really good corrective for politicians, for parents, and for policymakers that actually young people are very sophisticated at navigating this world. Yes, there are some problems. And we identify those, but actually they're really smart, and I think it's partly our generation doesn't understand. I leave Shoaib out of that, it was a younger generation, but it sometimes has that sort of panic that we don't quite get it, and therefore it must all be terrible. One of the things which Shoaib will add more detail to is we've got these three categories, which I think are reassuring for parents. It's not that everything fits neatly into them, but we talk about healthy stuff online, hyper stuff, and then harmful stuff. And those three H's, I think, actually just gives it a bit more framework.
So, Shoaib, enlighten us and fill us with a bit of positivity about the kind of things that really challenge our perceptions.
So, I mean, when Peter mentioned the three H's, as we call them, healthy, hyper, and harmful content online, a lot of the content that was consumed by the young people that we spoke to was incredibly healthy. They learn how to cook on there. They learn how to play the guitar. But a lot of it is a lot of the stuff that we're worried about and that gets the headlines and leads to moral panic is the hyper content. The stuff around, I mean, one thing that we found was really, really interesting was this idea around self-improvement. So many young men in particular want to be the best versions of themselves for a variety of reasons. I mean, a lot of them don't feel in control of their lives and their futures. They don't feel like they're going to have good housing so they try to find control where they can. So I was speaking to a teacher who was saying the amount of young men going to the gym and with six packs and big arms in high school is alarming. A lot of that comes from this kind of idea of hyper content online.
Yeah. Where does Andrew Tate fall into all of this? Because you can't have a conversation about teenagers and teenage boys in particular without his name coming up. But I absolutely loved what you found when his name did come up.
Yes, so you get. So our starting point is Andrew Tate is dead. Not literally, but in the eyes of these 16-year-olds. So when you mention Andrew Tate, they roll their eyes and they say, we've had the Andrew Tate Assembly. So I said, well, what's the Andrew Tate Assembly? Well, it's the head teacher who stood up in front of us and told us that Andrew Tate is a bad thing. I said, what else did they say? Well, not a lot, really. So it was a bit like the Just Say No campaigns for sex in the past. Which were incredibly ineffective, just to say, steer clear of Andrew Tate. So they are really smart. These 16-year-olds do not think Andrew Tate is the great man. They've navigated away from him. And there's a lot of other people who are influencing them.
But Shoaib, this is what's so key, I think, about the findings in your report, is actually teenagers want to turn away from things that make them feel bad, things that make them feel unwell, things that disturb them. It's a natural human reaction. And perhaps we just have not given credit because we're so rabbit in the headlights about what they have looked at. We don't give them credit for actually not falling for everything that's out there.
100%. And so many young people kind of find a way of detoxing themselves. So a lot of the young people that we spoke to took 6 months out of social media. I mean, before I started this project, I wasn't on social media for the whole summer. I went back on it for this project. And we were talking about the kind of content that is harmful towards young people.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of this content around, for example, there's a story about iShowSpeed, and he's one of the biggest influencers in all of the world. And he travels around the country, and he went to China, for example. And there's a story of how he is recording the world and showing the world.
And he was in China.
Yeah.
He was in China, being invited in. And he was shown everything and he did all these videos in China. And what was interesting in the comment sections, when people were looking at what he was doing in China, they were saying, we'd like a bit of China. They actually can build things. They can actually do things fast. So actually him going there demystified what was going on. So young people are being influenced. There's a lot of entertainment they're absorbing, but there's a political content often to what's going on underneath it.
So do you think that there has been a kind of curve of harm, and actually the teenagers who are a bit older, because they might not have had quite as much knowledge about what was out there on the internet, might actually have been more harmed by the things that they've seen and the habits that they've developed. And actually, the teenagers coming through are just a bit cannier about what they need to do in order to stay positive and safe?
I think they are a lot cannier. And to give you another example about news consumption, we keep hearing young people are only getting their news from social media. So we delved underneath that. And what was surprising, perhaps, was they say, yes, it's social media, but on our social media feed, we also get the BBC, or we also get Times Radio or whatever. And if we have any doubts about what we're looking at, we then Google it. And then they said, oh, and we've got the notifications on from serious news channels, and they give us that. And then about a third in one of the schools, a third of the young people said, oh, and my parents make me watch the 10 o'clock news every day as well. So it sort of demystifies this picture of they're not informed. And I'd say in comparison to someone who only reads one of the national newspapers and doesn't consume anything else, I'd say 16-year-olds are far better informed than them.
Yeah.
So again...
And yes, and of course, Shoaib, this generation and this particular demographic really matters, doesn't it? Because we have got a change in voting coming. So the politicians really want to make sure that they can reach these people. Are they cutting through, do you think, as much as they could?
As much as they could, definitely not. I mean, you look at Zohran Mamdani in New York and what he's been able to do, and at home, Zach Polanski and what he's doing now, and the podcast that he's created and the content that he's created. And he's done something that mainstream politicians in the main two parties haven't been able to do. He's identified where young people are online and he's gone to them. And I feel like Keir Starmer is trying to do a good job at that, and he's getting there, definitely. But there is a lot of work that the government can do and other mainstream political parties can do to make sure that, like, young people feel like they're being listened to. Zach Polanski offers something in his messaging that makes it clear to them that they're being listened to. He talks about third spaces. He talks about the lack of libraries, the lack of social clubs that young people can go to. I mean, just in London, it's incredible. Like, there's so many young people that have went out of their way. There's a guy called Kai who runs the board games club, and he brings together hundreds of young people that connect and come together and share their frustrations over board games. And Zach Polanski's been able to, I think, tap into something like that.
Yeah. If you look at just the number of followers for the leaders of the main parties on social media platforms, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because Nigel Farage is absolutely out there. And actually, Keir Starmer, I don't think, is number two. He's way down number three or number four on some of the platforms. So there is work to be done, isn't there?
There is work to be done. I wrote on my Substack, Changing the Story, I wrote five things that Keir Starmer could do right now to actually be a social media star, which people were quite sceptical about. But that he could do his own podcast.
And what Nigel Farage is incredible at is that a lot of the content that you see of Nigel Farage online is not from his account. He's incredibly memeable. So he understands that these short clips are the clips that are going to become, that are going to go everywhere. And people's first interaction with Nigel Farage might be from him, from I'm a Celebrity, might be him holding a beer, might be him getting a milkshake thrown on him. Or with Keir Starmer, he doesn't naturally feel that natural.
Yeah. You've got a 16-year-old brother, I think. Is there a big difference between you and him in terms of all of these things that we're talking about?
Usually. I mean, my parents were incredibly, incredibly strict. I got my first phone at 16. Imagine that. Like, my first phone at 16, my first interaction with social media was on Facebook, on my computer desktop, where my parents could see exactly what I was doing. Okay. My young brother has TikTok.
You have a family computer. Yeah, God, man.
No, we had this is a long time ago. We used to have to fight. I've got five siblings as well, so you can imagine what it was like fighting for the computer. But he got a phone at 9, and I was annoyed as hell at this. I was like 18 years old, and I told my mum, this is not fair. But he had a phone at nine. At the age of 11, he's on TikTok, and his algorithm is shaping the way that he feels. I mean, he's never bored. Imagine that. How much time I actually have to watch Miranda and not going out on BBC. We're talking about the BBC, but they've got great TV shows. And but
watching Miranda might have done us some level of good somewhere.
I mean, my not sense really. Of humour, that's why I get along with Peter so well, I think.
I've got a Miranda sense of humour.
Well, yeah, middle-aged. You're not middle-aged, you're very young.
And how old are you now?
I'm 26 now. 26, so I'm on what we call Gen Z 1.0, which is the older version of Gen Z. We had organic social media. My little brother's Gen Z 2.0, so he's two steps removed. He grew up in an age of AI. COVID was such a massive impact on his life, especially growing up. And his view on life and his view of the way that he sees his phone is very different to my view. I can do a detox and it feels like I can remove myself. But with him, he's not logging in to the online world. He's in the online world. He's constantly around him. The idea of him not being on social media is insane to him because he's like, well, how am I going to check what's going on in the world? Where I remember a time when my parents wouldn't let me out of the house after 5 p.m. and I didn't have a phone and I had to wait until Monday morning to see my friends. Yeah. And I had that, what have you been up to this weekend?
But no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's as if social media is just in every breath that they take, isn't it? And you really can't anymore say, you simply can't have access to that, you know, once it's in there and it's being breathed around by everybody.
Although we also found an appetite for more social connection, and actually quite a big appetite for a ban on social media for the under 16s. Mm. They wanted somehow something so they weren't the only one of their friends who were off it. They wanted something bigger than themselves, like a law, to be able to say, actually, we shouldn't be on it. So there's a bit of a surprising craving for that, I thought.
Well, it's lovely to have you both in the studio. Thank you very much indeed. And it's a really interesting report, because I think what we all need is actually some injection of reality and positivity. And we will only find that by asking the 16-year-olds themselves what they think about the world, not putting words into their mouth. Lovely to meet you both.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
I think also credit to some of the teachers who have drilled down exactly the sentiment of Andrew Tate so much that those 16-year-olds are sort of rolling their eyes and saying, oh, we've had the assembly. That sounds like an example where the students listen to their teachers and to their parents as well. Fascinating to have that conversation. I spoke to a teacher last week on Early Breakfast where they have, as a school, banned mobile phones, not just on the premises, but the students have got one of three brick phones they are allowed to commute with as well. So no smartphones on school or even to commute with them, to try and sort of stave off this sort of 16-year-olds being embedded into social media. So some schools sort of trying to turn the tide. Coming up though here, dynamic ticket pricing makes the leap from Oasis tickets to the opera, but why? This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mom was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were 2 for 1 at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world, baking. Mm. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help, it still is.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage, and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
This is Times Radio.
It's not really a duo we would have talked about before. Oasis and the Royal Ballet and opera together, a trio I should have said. Both the Royal Ballet and Oasis have used dynamic pricing, where demand for tickets defines how much you pay for them. A ticket, let's say, to watch the opera could set you back, gosh, a cool £400+. David Sanderson is arts correspondent at The Times and joins me now. David, what opera is worth £400?
Well, Royal Ballet and Opera would argue that the Ring Cycle is worth £400. So this is one of those sort of mouth-gaping moments when you see ticket prices have inexorably risen over the last few years, but this is a real landmark moment. So it's £415 to see the third instalment of the Ring Cycle, which, it has to be said, is, I guess, the ultimate artistic and logistical undertaking for any opera company. It's an enormous orchestra, an enormous chorus, an enormous ensemble, and the whole night will take up 6 hours of your time for that £415, albeit there is an hour-long dinner interval within that. So it is a landmark moment. This is the highest price I can find for any subsidised organisation, any price that they've been asking for. And it's, as you said, Oasis have got into a lot of trouble over their dynamic pricing model. And Royal Ballet and Opera, which has just introduced this system in the last couple of weeks, is insisting that they will have barriers on this and that people will pay what they expect to pay for the ticket.
It feels surprising that actually post that sort of furore over Oasis, the Royal Ballet and Opera have decided to go ahead with this as a policy. I was looking at some of their tickets online. Let's say you wanted to see the Nutcracker. You could stand up and I think get quite tired and see not very much for about £15, which sounds very reasonable. But you could, you know, sit down and we're talking £200 to maybe even £300. How much will the dynamic pricing alter those seats? Are they going to get more expensive, or could it be that if on the day there are some free, the price plummets?
Yes, I suspect that there won't be any free, but you're absolutely right. The principle is that it's all demand led. So if there is not the interest, then the price will drop. But I don't think that this in any way is a ceiling on the ticket price. There is, for example, there's a fourth installment of the Ring Cycle that's June 2027, and it is the longest of all four of them. So one suspects that we could well be approaching a £500 ticket for that. Now, in fairness to Royal Ballet and Opera, they argue that these higher prices, which people are willing to pay, do help subsidise the cheaper tickets, which you've referred to, you know, £15 for the Nutcracker, etc., etc. And they do still pale in comparison with prices in New York, for example, where a straight play, which is far less starting costs and running costs, and a ticket for Othello there starring Denzel Washington is almost £700 this year. So relatively cheap, and you know, there are people that are willing to pay this price. Clearly, albeit my salary certainly wouldn't justify it,
nor mine, I have to say. David, thank you. David Sanderson, the arts correspondent at the Times. The T's and C's on the Royal Opera House website says some tickets are market price, so prices may increase or decrease at any time. I know it's not hugely for you, the Nutcracker, but I can't really imagine there being a situation when there's not demand for the Nutcracker. So it does feel as though the demand is always going to be up, and therefore the prices as well, rather than prices going down.
I will have to take your word for it. We had this conversation in the production office before, and Rosie very sweetly asked me when the last time was that I went to the Royal Opera House. And I have to confess, I've never been.
Better than when I went to the ballet with my sister, who said, when are they going to start talking? Unfortunately, never.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
That must have been a very long night in the Wright household. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright. We're here for another hour on Times Radio. After the news, we'll talk to Dorothy Byrne about the BBC fiasco. Turn on your reading lamp, light the fire, curl up in the big chair. Our literary salon is open. Laura Hackett will join us for that. Adam Shaw does money and will ask, what is Grokopedia? It all happens after the latest news from Howard Bentham.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has sent a letter to the BBC threatening legal action over the editing of his speech, and the broadcaster will decide how to respond. The chair of the corporation has also apologised for an error of judgment in the Panorama documentary. In a letter, Samir Shah accepts the splicing of clips gave the impression of a direct call for violent action. Asked about Trump's letter and if the president is going to sue the BBC, Shah said that the corporation needed to be ready for all eventualities.
I do not know that yet, but he's a litigious fellow, so we should be prepared for all outcomes.
Head of News Deborah Turness, who's now stepping down, insists the BBC is still impartial.
Is there institutional bias at the BBC?
There is no institutional bias. Mistakes are made, but there's no institutional bias.
But why weren't the mistakes dealt with on Trump, on anti-Semitism, on women's rights?
I'm sure that story will emerge.
But that's rejected by Nigel Farage.
The BBC has been institutionally biased for decades.
People talk about election interference. What the BBC did was election interference.
Times Radio's Andrew Neil says that one of the issues affecting the BBC is a lack of divergence of thought.
The young people coming out of university these days who gravitate towards metropolitan-based organisations like the BBC are all coming with broadly the same mindsets, the same mindset that they've been given in university. And, you know, diversity is the great cry of the progressive, but the one thing where there is very little diversity these days in a place like the BBC is diversity of opinion.
The International Olympic Committee will announce a ban on transgender women in female competition early in 2026 after a review of evidence about the physical advantages of being born male. The IOC's new president, Kirsty Coventry, has promised to protect the female category. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy will be released from prison and placed under judicial supervision. It's less than 3 weeks since he started serving a five-year sentence for criminal conspiracy. Holidaymakers face attacks on flying as part of Keir Starmer's reset with the European Union. The Resolution Foundation think tank says the rules will add around £21 onto the cost of a long-distance journey. But aviation leaders have said it would incur significant future costs to the industry. Rupert Reid is the co-director of the Climate Majority Project and founder of Extinction Rebellion and told Times Radio that there was a smarter way to tax flights.
There is a better, fairer alternative available. It's called a frequent flyer levy. And what that means is that those who take more flights would pay proportionately more for their flights, whereas those who only take one or two would pay little or indeed nothing. So a frequent fly levy is actually the fair way to do it because it ratchets up the cost on those who take most flights.
And Ofgem is planning an overhaul of its customer service rules aimed at giving firms more flexibility to meet standards. The regulator says it wants to move towards a more outcomes-based approach, focusing on results rather than strict rules.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
That's us, but don't worry, Jane and I don't come round and fit those kitchens and bathrooms ourselves. Talented experts will be doing that for you. 4 minutes past three, it's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright with you for the rest of this week in the afternoons on Times Radio. Just a quick update for Claire, who says, help, where can we find this report? Well, it's from the Demos think tank, and it is very pleasing reading, especially if you've got that kind of age group somewhere in your life, 16, 17-year-olds. They've really done the business in terms of asking them how they feel about the world around them, and the answers are far more positive than we might usually give them credit for. Now, our big story today is obviously around the BBC. Two more lanyards will be handed in at BBC Security following the weekend seismic resignations. But what does the landscape now look like for the corporation? Well, Dorothy Byrne is former head of news at Channel 4, winner of numerous journalism awards, and can cast her eye of calm experience across the horizon of news chaos. Welcome to the programme, Dorothy. How are you?
Well, slightly traumatised today, because I think that what's happened to the BBC is bad news for all of us in television journalism. It will inevitably have undermined public trust in TV journalists.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that, because that is such a key point. And I also wanted to ask you for your thoughts about whether or not the BBC has been institutionally biased, and whether that partly would explain why everybody who sat in an edit or had to watch some rushes or an early cut of this panorama or the final cut just thought, well, yes, Donald Trump would say that, wouldn't he? We're good to go.
Well, actually, I don't think that the problem is institutional bias. I think the problem here was incompetence followed by defensiveness. Yes, several BBC executives sat there and watched this programme before it went out, and none of them realised there was potentially something wrong with it. But I think that was, as I say, I think it was incompetence. Why did it not strike them that somebody very senior needed to look at the little clip they used of the Donald Trump interview, speech, and then look at the whole Donald Trump speech and work out if it was fair to use that little clip? Because it wasn't fair. And they should have asked the question, has a very senior person looked at this whole speech and checked if it's fair? And then when they discovered in May, we are told, that there was something wrong with the way it was edited, they should have fessed up. And then when they were publicly exposed last Tuesday, they should have fessed up, definitely have fessed up. And it's the fact that they didn't fess up and apologise and they went on the defensiveness, which is really why two senior people have ended up resigning.
Yep.
If they had admitted what they did when they got it wrong, when they realised they'd got it wrong, they wouldn't have had to resign.
You've been in the room with people at this kind of level in our media landscape, Dorothy. So people would have asked those questions, wouldn't they, back in May and last week, what are we going to do? Why is it that something more understandable and logical and defensible doesn't come out of those meetings?
Well, why is the BBC the way it is, such a defensive organisation and so lacking in political nous? This is what we saw when they made the error over the Gaza film. It was revealed that they had allowed a child related to a Hamas official to narrate and star in a film about Gaza. Everybody was clamouring for some sort of explanation, justification, and they said nothing for 2 weeks. And it was in that two-week period that the whole of that row spiralled out of control. And it was in the nearly one-week period this time that this row spiralled out of control. They don't seem to have normal political nous. But also, it's a matter of morality, isn't it? When you discover that you made a mistake and therefore you misled the public, the moral thing to do would be to admit to the public, we need to tell you there was a programme last October which had a misleading edit in it, and we apologise for that. If they had done that, I doubt people would have thought, oh, well, that was a stupid mistake, and moved on with their lives.
Yep. There are delays all over the place, aren't there? There were delays over who knew what and when, and what colleagues were told about Hugh Edwards. This is an active case now with Tim Westwood, but many people within the corporation felt that there was a delay when people had first started making complaints about him. I mean, is it ever fair to say this is a very big corporation, the wheels just do move slower?
No, that's not acceptable. They really need to sort out their communications, but ultimately it's a matter of morality. If you are a moral organisation and you discover that you have misled your viewers and therefore breached regulations, which in both instances they did, you have a moral and a regulatory duty to inform the public. You do not have the right to be defensive. And we're told that the board of the BBC were all arguing between themselves as to what their apology and statement should say. So the answer to the fact they couldn't agree what to say was to say nothing at all, which is like a group of doctors thinking, oh, I wonder what is exactly the right dose of this tablet is to give to a patient. Well, we can't decide what to give him, so let's not give him anything at all and let him die.
Do you think that it might be a good idea in future if some of those meetings are actually accessed by us, the people who fund the BBC?
No, I don't, because
I'd love to see what goes on in the Board of Governors meetings, wouldn't you?
Oh, the Board of Governors meetings.
Yes, those.
Well, maybe bits of them, but I'm sure that there are all sorts of highly confidential matters, maybe discussions which are potentially libelous, which I don't think that is the solution. One of the things that has come up in both the Gaza case and this case is that there were several BBC executives involved. I mean, quite a number, more than five. And therefore, I would say in other organisations, normal ones like ITV and Channel 4, there are far fewer people involved. There might be one or two executives who have the key responsibility. And my view is, in journalism, if loads of people have responsibility, it ends up that nobody has a responsibility. So in the case of the Gaza film, we're told that at least three people, but probably more, knew that the film should not go out until it was ascertained whether or not any of the children had connections with Hamas. And yet the film went out. So how could that happen? If only one person, or at the most two, were responsible, they'd have said, oh, God, my name's on this. That film can't go out, because we don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, and I think it is an all too familiar criticism for anybody who's worked at the corporation, that there are too many people and there are too many people at a certain level, and it does exactly that. It just makes a kind of clear direction of travel very, very difficult to find. Can I take you back to what you said in your first answer, Dorothy, just about what the landscape loses if this really does hold the corporation below the waterline?
Well, first of all, it makes ordinary viewers, and in the end we're all ordinary viewers, aren't we, of other people's output, mistrustful. But the second thing that this particular case has done is empower Donald Trump. Donald Trump consistently rails against fake news by the mainstream media. Well, tonight, Donald Trump is able to say accurately, I called out the fake news by the mainstream media and I was right. They did indeed edit a clip of me to make me look bad. And this shows they're fake, fake, fake. And that's pretty galling. Imagine now being a BBC journalist sitting in a White House press conference. I mean, it must be mortifying.
Yeah. Do you believe that it might certainly for a while change the way that the media, certain parts of the media, the BBC, reports on Trump? So there would be more caveats. There would be more, he said this, but he also said that.
Well, if it meant that the BBC was more careful, that would be a good thing. But I actually think that the vast majority of BBC journalists are absolutely excellent journalists who are very careful in any case. And what we don't want is BBC journalists to be cowed and afraid to speak truth to power. Mm.
If you received the call to become the next DG, would you take the call? Would you take the job?
Certainly not. I don't wish to be ageist about myself, but I'm 73. And I'm also having too much fun.
Okay. Well, you're only 73.
Talking to you, for example.
Dorothy, I mean, you could have another 10 years on you and run to be president of a very large country. But in terms of what
good
the job...
point. But would I do it well?
Well, I can't possibly make a comment on that, Dorothy. I think you'd be absolutely excellent. But tell us just a little bit about what that job entails, because it is interesting that Tim Davey mentioned in his resignation speech that actually the personal load on him, as well as the professional load, was something that he was having to consider. He has weathered many storms. He's certainly had a very full in tray. That will continue for whoever it is who replaces him. Do you think it's just too much for one person to do?
I don't. I mean, it's a big job. Being the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is a big job. Oh, being the President of the United States is a very, very big job. But I think what recent events have shown us is that the Director General of the BBC should be somebody with hands-on programme experience. They don't necessarily need to be a very, very experienced journalist, but they should be somebody who understands programmes. One of the key things about being a programme maker is that you're used to reacting very quickly. You know, if you're in the middle of making a programme and something suddenly changes in the world, we are used in TV to suddenly throwing out our whole running order and doing it differently. And that's what the BBC needed to do here. It needed to throw out its whole running order and write a new script for what it was going to do. And it couldn't do that. It sat there sticking to the old script.
Dorothy, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Dorothy Byrne is former head of news at Channel 4. Any thoughts on that? We're 0333 002353.
Steve says the British Broadcasting Corporation is our state broadcaster, paid directly by the vast majority of the UK population. This, like Lammy at our dispatch box, is a betrayal of trust, which is the definition of treachery. It all comes down, really, I think, to trust in terms of what happens next for the BBC in whatever iteration it looks like. Who is paying for it? Is it, how do they restore what I think has been damaged, not irretrievably, trust in the eyes of those who read the BBC News website, listen to the radio and watch their television news programmes as well. Lots to come here on the programme, though. We will be moving on for now. We're exploring Elon Musk's second bid at taking over the internet with the rise of Grokopedia. Talking of trust, that conversation will continue. It's 20 past three. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
John Pienaar on Times Radio. Trusted journalism.
As you've heard already, some of the material is so sensitive, wounding, difficult to hear, especially for the loved ones of the victims in this case.
Intelligent analysis.
It's been called a new industrial revolution, which may be overexcitable, but it certainly feels like one.
And diverse opinion.
For Britain to succeed as an economy, as the home of public services that are broken and on their knees, this plan has to succeed.
John Pienaar at Drive. This afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
You plan a holiday, you plan a commute, meal plans, career plans, even workouts need a plan. So doesn't it stand to reason that your money has one too? Because the sad truth is, if it doesn't, it's just sitting there, barely growing, if at all. That's why you need a money plan, and Quilter can help. It's a lot easier to stick to than a workout plan. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Nice. Direct Line just sorted me a courtesy van while they're fixing mine after my accident. That's how it's done.
Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like clients paying you on time.
All done.
Brilliant. Your invoice is all paid up, left you 5-star reviews. Oh, and a bit extra in there for staying late that time. And I baked this cake for you too.
Nice.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Comprehensive cover required. Courtesy van limited for up to 21 days if your van is written off, stolen, or you use your own repairer. Excludes windscreen claims.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silver Sea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more, Learn more at silversea.com.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms, the experts in design and installation. From plumbing and tiling to electrical work, the Wix Bathroom Installation Service can take care of everything. Start your journey today by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
22 minutes past three, good afternoon. Now, Elon Musk's Wikipedia page has been edited more than 17,000 times since 2008. The world's richest man has long disliked the online encyclopedia, branding it Wokipedia. He's now launched his own competitor, powered by his own AI, which is called Grok, and so the website is called Grokopedia. Well, the Wikipedia founder, Jimmy Wales, spoke to Times Radio back in August, and he said he didn't think AI was going to be too bad for his website.
Because AI depends so heavily on Wikipedia, it cites us quite a lot. Now, people click through a little less, so the traffic kind of balances out. But obviously, the AI companies are all acutely aware that they need good quality input. Wikipedia is freely licensed. It's available for that. We're happy to be part of the infrastructure of the world. And so, you know, we do think there's a place for human curation for the foreseeable future.
That was the founder of Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales. Well, with us now is Bruce Daisley, former vice president at Twitter, which is now, of course, called X under Elon Musk's ownership. Bruce, good afternoon.
I never worked for him. I escaped.
You escaped before Elon Musk took over. And how it's changed, actually, since Elon Musk has been overseeing now X. What do you think he's trying to achieve with this Grokopedia, which works very differently to how Wikipedia does? Wikipedia is written by a community. It has volunteer editors. It's not for profit. This is something very different.
I just find the whole thing so immensely curious. Before Elon Musk bought Twitter, he used to rage about wanting to know what the algorithm was. He wanted to know what the computer was deciding, what priors it brought to every decision. Then when he took it over, he announced that he was going to publish the algorithm. In fact, when he did at one stage publish it, one of his engineers had to admit that the number one thing in the algorithm was giving priority to Elon Musk's own tweets. And if anyone's used the product, they'll definitely see the benefit of that. This seems to be taking it to the next stage. One of the things that we've heard accusations about, people who have conversations with ChatGPT, is that ChatGPT tends to err on the sycophantic. It tells you that all of your ideas were brilliant. That draft novel that you entered, it tells you it only needs a bit more polishing and it could yet win the Booker. And he seems to have created his own version of this, something which is just intent on celebrating the genius of its master.
This is Grok you're talking about, and it's now Grokopedia, right, which is the competitor to Wikipedia. Now, it's using AI, isn't it, to build entries? And I have to say, from my very brief look at it before the programme started, I decided to search into Grokopedia Times Radio, and what I got back was an entry, but a very dense one that was littered with errors. I mean, it hadn't actually managed to get right the Times Radio schedule, which is obviously published on multiple places on the internet and accurately. So this is part of the problem, isn't it? Grokopedia is scouring from the web. It doesn't have, like Wikipedia, people to check, edit, correct.
Yeah, that's right. I think some people have done side-by-side comparisons and suggested that there does seem to be more than a gentle influence from Wikipedia. But then there's some sort of filtering that's gone on that attempts to try and impose Elon Musk's own worldview on various situations. So by all accounts, Tesla comes out very well. Elon Musk comes out very well. And some of his perspectives on his political hobby horses. So he's got a vested interest in South African politics and they seem to come out sort of biased. It raises the question, what's the point of this? Because if Wikipedia at least had the wisdom of the crowds, that it was something that was consensual, it had established rules of etiquette of how things are edited. Why Elon Musk seems to kind of borrow it and yet subvert it at the same time. It sort of begs this really interesting question, what's his ultimate end game? I think like most things with Elon Musk, it's an attempt for attention. He loves being in the spotlight. He loves us thinking about him. He loves us having to think about what Elon's thinking at every moment of the day. It's just a it's another rather sorry attempt for the richest guy in the world, the richest guy in history, yet again to try and insert himself into our attention.
And people on X use grok. And if you're not familiar with this world, these are under kind of crazy terms, but people do use grok. Do you think they'll use grokopedia?
The thing you've got to credit Grok with is that at any point, if you do find yourself on the site, you can click on a little icon. It's like a sort of a subverted zero. You can click on that and it will tell you the context of any tweet. And I have to say, at times it is dazzling. You might click on that context for a meme that is baffling you. You have no idea why people are sort of laughing at this image. And it will give you the full sort of a hand on the shoulder. It will give you the full analysis of why this meme suddenly now makes sense. So you have to accept that at times he's certainly got a good ability to harness technology in a productive way. The thing about this is that possibly it doesn't necessarily have a role. It doesn't necessarily have a function. There wasn't a gap in the market for Grokopedia. His intention is to try and bring AI interpretation to the total mass of human knowledge, and it just doesn't necessarily seem to have a purpose. I think he's especially upset because at times, like with most things that he looks at, he thinks Wikipedia is a touch woke. And I think that means, from what I can gather, he doesn't always agree with his opinion on things.
Yeah, he's made that clear, hasn't he, calling it woke, yeah. Wokopedia from time to time. I wonder, actually, because grok is used, yes, as you say, on X a lot for context. That's sort of the best example I've seen of it being used. The problem for Elon Musk, actually, is OpenAI's ChatGPT, which does seem to be strides ahead of where grok is right now.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we're sort of looking at a horse race, aren't we, where we're looking at products that seem at times to be dazzling and way ahead, and then they all seem to catch up with each other. If anyone's seen recent innovations that Google have done on video generation, then it seems utterly dazzling. And then a couple of months later, everyone's able to do it. And so we are in a very fast-moving market. One of the challenges is that ultimately these products are going to be marketed to organizations. So your company might use them to power a chatbot. And Grok until now has been rather raw. It's willing to do some things in terms of images that other sites wouldn't do. It's willing to say curse words that other sites wouldn't do. And if ultimately the end game on most of these products is to power chatbots or to power office-based technology, then you wonder if having a slightly potty-mouthed AI assistant might struggle to find some use in the workplace. It's an interesting strategy. Look, he's been right more times than he's been wrong. But having a sort of gnarly and quite prickly AI chatbot, I think, hasn't necessarily proved that there's a gap in the market for it.
Yeah, I wouldn't want it helping me out with sort of HR or any work-related problems, certainly. Bruce, thank you. Bruce Daisley, the former vice president at Twitter. Matt makes a really, I think, important point on WhatsApp. He says, if we can't rely on AI to be right, it has no value whatsoever, however much context it can present about a meme or whatever. Because I do have this sense, Fee, if I check something on X and there's sort of a grok explanation, I always want to then double check. Yeah. And that kind of knee-jerk reaction hasn't gone, really. And even with OpenAI, ChatGPT, I want to sort of think, oh, I'm just going to Google that as well before I sort of take that on authority.
I think you're wise to do so. And actually, we better protect ourselves if we keep in our head the idea that maybe two sources are very good things. Just a couple of very quick messages. Hugh says, it's disingenuous to say that the edit of the Trump speech doesn't represent bias. Can you ever imagine a similar thing occurring with a Kamala Harris speech? And Dominic just says, and this is with regard to the delightful little anecdote you provided us with regarding a member of your family on going to the ballet who said, when are they going to start talking? Dominic says, perhaps ask when they're going to stop dancing. And that's how I feel about the ballet too, Dominic. Coming up, we open the doors of our literary salon with the Times Books team. Don't judge me. First, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Howard Bentham.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker.
This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has sent a letter to the BBC threatening legal action following the uproar over the misleading editing of a speech by the US president in a Panorama documentary. The BBC have said they will review the letter and respond directly in due course. The chair of the corporation, Samir Shah, has also apologised for an error of judgment in the Panorama documentary. Scotland's First Minister, John Swinney, says there are big lessons to take from the situation.
All of us must be able to rely on the BBC to be an authoritative and neutral voice. And never has that been more important than it is today in relation to misinformation and disinformation.
The International Olympic Committee says no decisions have been taken yet amid reports transgender athletes could be banned from the female category in all Olympic events. The Times is reporting that athletes born male were set to be barred after a scientific review found male advantages remained even after athletes took steps to reduce testosterone levels. A second migrant who was returned to France under the government's one-in-one-out scheme has come back to the UK. The Home Office says the man will be returned as soon as possible. The US Senate has passed a deal aimed at ending its longest ever government shutdown. It's been reached after a weekend of negotiations in Washington, in which a minority of Democrats joined with Republicans and voted in favour of an agreement. And former BBC Radio 1 DJ Tim Westwood has been granted conditional bail during a court appearance to face charges of rape and sexual assault. The 68-year-old who denies any wrongdoing is accused of offences against seven women. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
They say we all come into this world alone, but that's not how we live it, nor should it be how we leave it. At Marie Curie, we believe no one should face end of life alone. When there's no cure, we care, whatever the illness. Day or night, our support is there to help ease any pain and protect your dignity. In your home, in our hospices, and over the phone. Marie Curie. Whatever the illness, we're with you to the end. Call us on 0800 090 2309 or visit mariecurie.org.uk.
Co-op members now get prices matched to Aldi. Hold on. No way. Okay then, so co-op members now get everyday essentials price matched to Aldi. Sign up and start saving. Co-op. Owned by you, right by you. I wasn't expecting that.
Co-op member prices matched versus comparable selected products at Aldi GB. Co-op membership required. Co-op group food stores only. See co-op.co.uk/Aldi price match.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Right, a little gentle lighting, put some olives in a bowl, pour yourself a martini, get your reading glasses. It's time for our literary salon. We welcome Laura Hackett to the studio. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. That's more me manifesting how I'd like this segment to go, but nobody ever brings any olives in, and the lighting is a source of continued controversy here at Times Radio. Let's talk about the lack of light, a 700-page epic. Sorry, somebody's just turned around from editorial and given me a little bit of a look. Oh, that's brilliant. The lights have gone pink. That is absolutely brilliant. That is much more...
Look, an improvement.
Our blood pressure's gone down. The speed at which we speak has gone down. Laura, tell us about The Lack of Light.
So The Lack of Light is a Georgian novel. And actually, Robbie Millen is not very long back from a holiday to Georgia. And reading this novel has kind of made me want to go. Although when I explain what it's about, you'll probably think you're a bit mad. It's basically like Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan Quartet, which is all about, based around a friendship between women. This is the same thing. It's about four women who grow up together in Georgia, but they're growing up and coming of age when Georgia is going through a crisis point. So it's at the very end of the Soviet Union, sort of 1989. Our main character, Kito, is finishing school, figuring out what to do with her life. And then the Soviet army is in. They're really repressive. And then the Soviet Union collapses. And it's chaos. There are bread queues. There's corruption. Paramilitaries take the power. And then there's a civil war. So it's seeing her life and the lives of her friends through that time. And how, even when things are really terrible and scary, a lot of the time the things they're worried about are their boyfriends and how they're doing at school, and is so-and-so moving elsewhere, and what dress are we going to wear to our prom? And I just really loved that mixture of, there's a lot of melodrama in it, lots of things happen, but at its heart it is about female friendship, and I really enjoyed that.
Now, it's a 700-page epic, isn't it?
Yes.
So that is quite a long journey that you're taking yourself on. Does it manage to maintain the momentum all the way through?
Mainly, I think it does. It uses quite a clever tactic, which is one of the friends, Dina, was a photographer, grew up to be a very famous photographer, and the friends are at an exhibition of her work and they're seeing the photographs of themselves as they grew up. And that is used as a way of basically giving us all the most interesting stuff, because if a photograph has been taken, then something quite exciting has happened. So no, I don't think it actually flagged the whole way through, but it is very long. So it's one of those ones, I quite like reading big books in the winter when you can kind of just sit down and curl up with something. So if you're looking for a book like that, you could go for The Lack of Light, but I'm also going to recommend another very long book.
Okay. Is
there's lots to choose from.
Is that The Wax Child?
It's not. The Wax Child is very short. So The Wax Child by Olga Ron, that is, she's a Danish author, and this book is set in 17th century Denmark during a witch trial. And I think there are lots of novels written about witch trials, and obviously plays, The Crucible, and lots of them kind of turn on the idea that these women weren't witches at all. What's quite fun about this one is they are, in her imagination at least. It's based on a true story, but she imagines, what if they really were witches? And more so, what if the story was told by the little wax child that they make and put in people's fingernails and hair if they wanted to harm those people? And the wax child is watching everything as it happens. So it's a really, really unusual book. But I just found it so gripping, and it was such an unusual narrator. The child can see everything, understands people in a way that they might not even understand themselves.
That's such a brilliant concept, because you're right that actually sometimes when you're reading throughout history about witches and the total injustice of so many people being called witches, sometimes you do think, well, I really wish that they were, because then they could come back and cast a spell over all these horrible men who were taking them to weird courts and dunking them and drowning them and all of that. So all power to the witches. So that's The Wax Child by Olga. Now you say Ron.
I think I sort of met her at an event last week, and she said that she actually tried out some spells when she was researching and writing the book. So she was a very cool lady, but I didn't want to get on the wrong side of her. So the book is really good.
The book is excellent. Isn't it great, Rosie? It's really super.
Yes.
It's spelt R-A-V-N, if
yes.
People want to do a bit of a search for that. So finally, the Booker Prize winner will be announced tonight, and you want to discuss just one of the shortlisted books.
So I've sort of slowly been working my way through a lot of them, and this one is one that I've just started over the weekend, called The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny by Kiran Desai. And whether it wins or not, I'm going to keep reading it, I think. So Kiran Desai actually won the Booker Prize several years ago for another book called The Inheritance of Loss, and this is her first book since then. So if she won it again, that would be a real double whammy for her. This is another very long book. It's sort of 600 pages or so. And it's about the two main characters, Sonia and Sunny. They're both students who have left their home in India to come and study in the US. And the narrative goes back and forth between their lives. You know, they're quite lonely. They're making their way in the world. Will they meet? Will they be drawn to each other? And the lives that they left behind at home. This is one that I would say, it's not quite like The Lack of Light in that you feel that Kiran Desai isn't too worried about always keeping the tension high and it very piercy. You can feel her sort of luxuriating in the fact that, yeah, I can spend two pages describing what the snow outside Sonia's window looks like. And I think for some people that's really amazing and a really interesting read. For other people, they might want something a bit more pacey. So I think you'll have to judge for yourself, what kind of a reader are you? Do you enjoy lots of different meanderings, subplots, new characters introduced, and then we say goodbye to them? Or do you just want a story that goes from A to Z? And if you want a story that goes from A to Z, The Loneliness of Sonia and Sonny is not for you.
Fair
but
enough.
I've been enjoying it.
How long does it take you to read a 600, 700 page book?
The Lack of Light, I did have a deadline. I had to write my review. So I think I read that one in 3 days.
Whoa. Okay.
But that was a lot of like just sitting and reading it for long stretches of time. And I did a bit of traveling. So I always find if I'm ever having to take a flight, that's amazing because I literally can't go on my phone. I can't do anything else. So that's quite useful. But for I'm not on a deadline with the Kiran Desai, so I might take a few weeks and dip in and out of it and read other things too.
Do you ever do what I'm often tempted, and this I think is a sign of a bad book, is when you have to start writing down who the characters are and who they're related to. So you know when you have all those subplots and you think, oh, I'm actually lost, I've got to go back to my own sort of notes to make sure I know what's happening with the plot.
Well, actually, when I opened up this book, I opened up the first page and it started with a family tree and a list of characters, and I thought, here we go. What have I let myself in for? It was the same with The Lack of Light, actually. And actually, the Elena Ferrante books do that too, because they go expand over a long period of time, which is useful. But I think it's always it's a bit of an intimidating moment when you open a book and you think,
isn't it just?
Yeah.
And actually, Rosie and I are both reading Katie Prescott's fantastic book about the life and death of Mike Lynch. And because that is such a complicated story to tell, I mean, this is fact, not fiction, there are three pages of people at the beginning that she needs to introduce us to in order to tell that story. But I'm so grateful to her for doing that, because absolutely, Rosie,
I would have done my own list otherwise.
I would have had to do a great big, you know, like one of those, you know, when somebody in a crime series finds a shed that's dedicated to the crime and they've got all those bits of string going up to photographs and places and times like that. I'd need one of those. And also, I did want to just ask you your thoughts about Helen Garner winning the Bailey Gifford, because I confess I hadn't read any of the other books on that shortlist, but when I saw her there and then when she won, I was so, so pleased, because actually it is just the voice of a woman telling us about her life. And actually, I should take the word just out of that. But that's what it is. And I think for that to be recognised in that outstanding field is quite something. Would you agree?
Completely agree. I think Helen Garner is such a fascinating writer. And she's someone who I think has not really had the recognition that she deserves, in Britain at least, because she's an Australian writer. And the fact that she was able to go through and be so sort of reckless in a way with how vulnerable and how open she is in these diaries, because she's sort of tracking the downfall of a marriage and everything that she suffered through that she was willing to be so open, I think is just fantastic. And also, even aside from the sense of how brave she is or how noble it is, it's just a brilliant read. I mean, I love getting a bit of an insight into someone's life, and knowing that it's real is just makes it even better.
And she really delivers, doesn't she? I mean, in terms of the nuggets that she leaves on every page, it's quite mind-boggling. So all hail Helen Garner. Lovely to see you, Laura. Thank you very much indeed. And Ron has said, pastel lighting. You guys are sounding even better, and I think we did. We have been discussing The Lack of Light, The Wax Child, and The Loneliness of Sonia and Sonny.
We've also been discussing Across the Day here, and that will continue with John Pienaar. He's here in 15 minutes. Really, the repercussions of the numerous mistakes that were made editorially at BBC News and the resignations. Derek has said, everyone's describing these BBC failings as mistakes. This is on WhatsApp, Derek messages. He says, a mistake is something that happened by accident, inadvertently. Trump's video splicing, broadcasting unverified Hamas propaganda, editing LGBT commentary and all the rest of it can only be described as deliberate acts. Someone carefully thought about what they were doing, not mistakes. we've heard an awful lot, and we've had an apology in the last couple of hours, actually, at lunchtime from the BBC chairman about what happened with that Donald Trump piece and how the two pieces of footage ended up together when they were about broadcast, actually, in real time, about 50 minutes apart from each other. But there'll be much more scrutiny of all the decisions that the broadcaster have been making, and we'll continue that conversation here. But coming up here on this show, our money expert, Adam Shaw, answers your questions on everything from pensions to personal finance. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mom was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were 2 for 1 at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world, baking. Mm. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help, it still is.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
We travel to explore, to learn, to connect. At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Our itineraries are designed to help you explore and engage with your destination through its food, culture, and customs. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
This is Times Radio.
So Rosie is sitting in for Jane all of this week, but the off-air podcast continues and Jane will be joining us from a secluded, remote and sheltered location. So off-air will continue to drop at 6 o'clock into your inboxes. And you always get a chance to hear the 3:30 interview in full again on the podcast. Recently, we've had David Olushoga, Joanna Lumley, Richard Coles. And last week, Jane spoke to Lady Glenconner, former lady-in-waiting, to Princess Margaret. She told Jane that Queen Elizabeth probably did spoil Andrew.
It was this thing after the war that we wanted to spoil our children, I think.
Yes.
And I think that's probably what she did.
You and your circle who spent time with the royal family, were there mutterings about the way Andrew conducted himself?
Well, not really. I mean, I didn't see him very much. He was quite forceful. I mean, I remember him snatching toys away from my son a bit like that. You
even
know?
As a baby?
Yeah, he was a handful. I think that's what his nanny called him, a handful.
Right, OK, well, we all know that. You can download that and many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcasts from.
This week, our money man, Adam Shaw, is answering a number of questions that you've sent him tackling how to deal with a difficult pension company that won't give you access to your pension savings, how to organise the finances of your freelance life, and whether to move pension where you change jobs. Adam, it is brilliant to have you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Shall we kick off with this first question? It's from a person who has started her first, described as big job, after a series of part-time roles. She's in her 20s. She says, I've worked for a couple of small companies and now have a longer-term job. I've already got a few pension pots. I can imagine this will get more and more complex. Should I move my pension pots to a new company so it's easier to keep track?
I think this is the big issue for a lot of people starting work, because really the newer generations are likely to work for 10, 15 different careers or employees over their lifetime. And therefore, if they're going to have a pension, you could end up in retirement with 15 different pension pots and you've forgotten half of them and you'll lose a lot of money. And that is not a small thing. There's something thought to be over 3 million lost pensions in this country worth over, I've got to forget, £31.1 billion of lost pension. There's people just losing track of their money. So, in terms of making your life easy and manageable, the obvious thing is to say, yes, we'll just move the pension with you. And generally, I think certainly if you're younger, that's not a bad idea in most circumstances. The reason I'm hesitant is that be careful if you do this, especially if you've got older pensions. The older pension might have come with some guarantees that you can't get anymore.
How old is an older pension?
Oh, how old is an old person? You know, that's a minefield to get into. The thing to look out for is not so much the age, but is, and this is the question, you want to check, are there any guarantees with this pension I'm going to move? And you might lose those guarantees. So ask the original pension provider the costs of the transfer, because there may be a difference in the transfer value and the pot value. Generally not, but it's worth checking, and whether I will lose any guarantees. And if that's not the case, then in most workplace pensions, the costs are relatively the same. They're limited by law. So again, check the costs, in which case, if all those give you a green light, there's no particular reason not to move the pension, and it makes it easier for you.
And is there any service where you can check if you have one of those lost 300, how many said, million pensions?
Yes, there is the government's pension tracing service. Be careful with that. I put it into Google, and I actually hit on a commercial website by mistake, which had a very similar name. So the government's pension tracing service is free. If anyone tries to charge you something, you are not on the right site. What it enables you to do is you can put in the company you worked for, the year you worked there. It will tell you who the pension provider was for that company. Now, of course, you still got to remember you worked for Company X. You may not remember that 20 years ago. This should change, hopefully next year, when something called the pension dashboard will come into place. Something online, which, just like a car dashboard, will show you all the pensions you've had over your career. They've been promising it for a long time. It's never come. I am promised it happens next year, believe that or not.
And then you may unearth some of those lost hundreds that have been somewhere.
You may, but certainly for the future, that should be easier. If that comes in, that should be easier.
Great. Now, the other end of the scale here, we've got a problem. Someone who would like to take money out of their pension, but they're being blocked by their pension company. This is a pension scheme they were in sort of in the end of the 80s. What went wrong here, and what do you do if you're hitting sort of administrative hurdles to actually getting the money? Yeah.
This is a bit of an odd situation. I've not heard of anyone in this particular situation before, and we've written up the details on the website. So if you're interested or in a similar situation, you can see the story there in full. The issue here is this woman is not being allowed access to a pension because she says, they say, you've got to get the signatory of the trustee of the original pension. But the company went bust. It was 30 years ago. There is no trustee. And she goes, well, tell me who I should get this signed by. And the pension company goes, well, I don't know. So for a year now, she's been trying to access this pension and cannot get it. It doesn't make any sense to me. Normally, the trustees will only get involved if you're trying to access your pension early or go against the regulations in some way, and they've got some laterality here. That doesn't seem to be the case. So that's the problem. What I would do to solve it, write to the Chief Executive Office. There's lots of websites which should give you their email address, their office email, not their personal email. If you can't get it there, look at LinkedIn or indeed the company website. Complain to the CEO office. It often carries a lot more weight. Explain it in simple, polite terms and say if you don't get satisfaction, you will escalate this to an official complaint. If you don't, make an official complaint. There is a process and you need to go through that. If you still don't get what you want, you can then go to the regulator. There's two different regulators here, a pensions regulator and the financial ombudsman, and they won't want to be taken there. And from what I understand of this case, it seems you would win this case. You shouldn't have to go through that. I don't think you will do, but that's the end thing. You can go to the regulator and say, it's my money. I want it.
Yeah, I'm owed it.
I owed it. Give it
Understood.
To me.
The final question we have here, a freelancer who's asked says, sometimes I work for companies who deduct tax at source, sometimes for companies who don't. This individual says, how do I keep track of it all to then make sure I've paid the right amount of tax when I fill out my tax return?
Yeah, two issues here. Both, I think, will apply to a lot of people. Increasingly, we have portfolio careers where you're working for two or three different people. Some have different employment schemes than others. So First, to answer your first question, how do you keep track of it? Not particularly easy. You can do it on a sort of spreadsheet, a bit boring, difficult. There are websites, there are software packages, the most famous which are QuickBooks and Xero, X-E-R-O, I think it's pronounced Xero, both of which, though, cost. And they're quite expensive. There's another one called QuickFile, which is free. There are a couple of free ones, but I found where every time you actually go there and want to do anything, they cost you. But QuickFile, to me, does look like it is actually free for basic stuff, QuickFile. And then you can issue invoices. Even if the person doesn't need an invoice, issue it, because then at the end of the year, you've got a record. And then if they've deducted PAYE tax, you deduct it on the invoice. And at the end of the year, you go, oh, how much tax have I paid and how much haven't I paid? And you fill that out on the tax return and HMRC will calculate that. Sorry, one other thing that's really important, especially if you've got lots of different companies that you're working for, you need to get a P60, a form which will tell you how much you've earned from that company for each one you've worked for, if you're currently employed, or a P45 if you sort of stopped working for them, and gather those all up and it will calculate the tax you have paid.
Now, at what point of the complexity of your finances is it better to say you get an accountant for that freelancer?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. If you've fairly straightforward a tax return, you should be able to do this yourself. And indeed, we're going taxes digital soon, where anyone who has to fill out a tax return will have to do it online. So simple things should be able to be done without an accountant. And indeed, I think for what's called sort of minimal income, like you're allowed a trading allowance of, I think it's £1,000, where you just don't have to bother about the paperwork. So I think for most individuals, you probably don't need an accountant unless you're trying to do something clever. But remember, if you are freelance, you have costs. So you can deduct the costs from your income, which will lower your tax. And if that gets complex, you might want an accountant.
Which would be a cost as well.
Which would be a cost, which is why I was saying it's probably best to try it without. And if you really feel unable to do that, you get an accountant. But if you followed what I've said and got all your paperwork, then the accountant will cost you less because you've done a lot of the boring paperwork.
Excellent. Adam, thank you very much. Adam Shaw, the business journalist. Adam's written up the responses to all of those questions, so you can find them at www.themoneydoctor.tv and on his socials, Adam Shaw Biz. And it sounds for you as though we're heading to the promised land of digital pensions and digital tax.
Well, that'll be simple to use, won't it? Nothing could possibly go wrong there.
A password or an extra login or a government gateway ID or whatever they're called.
Yes, or two-step authentication. Oh, just kill me now. This one comes in from Ron, who says that he has just ordered Katie Prescott's book on Audible. Well, you'll be delighted to know that she is on the programme this week talking about the curious case of Mike Lynch, the improbable life and death of a tech billionaire. And it is an intriguing story, not least because he died on the same day as the accountant of Autonomy. That was the company that they had sold to Hewlett-Packard, embroiled in all kinds of things. And the chance of that happening naturally, a 4 in 1 billion. Much more to talk about. Our producer today was Rosie Cutler. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Rosie Wright and I will see you through the whole of this week's afternoons. We're back tomorrow at 2. Up next, it's John Pina with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thanks, Rosie. Thanks, V. It's 4 o'clock. I'm John Pina, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Donald Trump's lawyers say the BBC must retract the Panorama documentary or face a lawsuit for $1 billion. And Rachel Reeves has heavily hinted Labour's manifesto pledge not to hike income tax will be ditched in her budget. And coming up, we're going to be looking at the future of the BBC. Times Radio's Adam Bolton and the Times columnist Matthew Syed are going to be debating here with us. And you can hear my long-ranging interview with the former Cabinet Secretary and now crossbench peer Simon Case.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Howard Bentham.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump's lawyers have said that the BBC must retract the Panorama documentary or face a lawsuit for no less than $1 billion. It's over the misleading editing of a speech by the US president. The BBC's chairman, Samir Shah, has apologised for an error of judgment. But former director of BBC Television Danny Cohen has told Times Radio the corporation's impartiality issues run deeper than this one example.
This is not just about the doctored, manipulated Trump video. I think it's about what Mr. Prescott has said in his report around systemic bias across quite a wide range of subjects the BBC reports on. That includes Israel and the Hamas war, the American presidential election, gender ideology.
It's led to the Director General Tim Davie resigning. Head of News Deborah Turness, who's also leaving her role, denies the corporation is institutionally biased. That's rejected by Reform UK leader Nigel Farage.
The BBC has been institutionally biased for decades. I mean, people talk about election interference. What the BBC did was election interference.
Scotland's First Minister has said that the BBC board member, Sir Robbie Gibbs' position, is now untenable amid the bias accusations aimed at the broadcaster. Sir Robbie served as Director of Communications for Theresa May when she was in Downing Street before his appointment to the broadcaster's board. Rachel Reeves has all but admitted Labour's manifesto pledge not to hike income tax will be ditched in her budget. The Chancellor said sticking to the election promise not to increase taxes for working people could only be met with deep cuts to public investment, which could derail hopes of future economic growth. The Times is reporting that the International Olympic Committee is set to announce a ban on transgender women in female competition early next year after a review of evidence about the physical advantages of being born male. However, the IOC says no decisions have been taken yet about banning transgender athletes from the female category in all Olympic events. The possible changes come under its new president, Kirsty Coventry, who's promised to protect the female category. The Times sports editor Tom Clark says that there would be still a few hoops to jump through.
That there's still, you know, the legal ramifications of this. They've got to make sure that this is watertight from that point of view. And it's we believe that they won't announce this until the new year. So, you know, we're in November now. There'll be a reaction to this and subsequent discussions, I'm sure. So, as you say, it's been discussed for a long time. And I think it's probably the most significant thing, as I say, was Kirsty Coventry's appointment as the new president of the IOC.
Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been released from prison and is being placed under judicial supervision. It's less than 3 weeks after he started a five-year sentence for criminal conspiracy in a scheme to finance his 2007 election campaign with funds from Libya. The 70-year-old who denies wrongdoing spoke to a court in Paris via a video link. Former Tesco boss Sir Dave Lewis has been named as the new chief executive of Guinness maker Diageo. He'll start the position next year on an annual salary of £1.5 million. And don't forget, you can set the Times News briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I am John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, I'm a BBC old boy. Yes, another one. And I don't imagine the BBC desperately wants or needs my advice. We're rivals of the BBC here, and every listener we can pull in our direction is another reason to celebrate. But we all have to pay for the BBC, or face a £1,000 fine. And more than that, we've all got a stake in the BBC earning its keep as the national broadcaster, doing its job and doing it at a standard of fairness and quality that gives Britain a service worthy of trust. And by the way, it gives us an organisation we can be proud to compete with. So all of that said, for what it's worth, if anyone at the BBC or outside believes that it can come through the latest row, which has seen off its Director General and Chief of News in a way that solves its problems and leaves everyone satisfied, that the BBC's fair and accurate and impartial in the way that it presents its news, forget it. It cannot happen, and it won't happen. For one thing, many of those who demand impartial news are really demanding news that's closer to their point of view. You can't please everyone. It is daft to try. For another, the edits of Donald Trump's rallying cry to the angry mob who marched on the US Congress on that January the 6th, well, that edit was crass, stupid, and misleading. It was also a gift to those who want to deny that Trump lied when he said the 2020 American election was stolen from him and whipped up a mob to try to stop the result being certified because Trump did all of those things. But if he sues the BBC, as he's threatening to do, for a billion
$1 million. Well, the case could be a nightmare for the BBC, to say nothing of the White House shutting its doors to its journalists. Now, today, the BBC chairman, Samir Shah, has apologised for that poor piece of TV journalism and hinted that action will be taken. Maybe too late. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the lessons the BBC might learn from this mess, how the national broadcaster might change in future, and whether there'll be more and maybe fiercer rows up ahead. And here's a spoiler alert. There will be. I wonder what you're thinking. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. So, let's look on where we are. The BBC has confirmed it's received a letter from Donald Trump threatening to sue for $1 billion if it does not retract that Panorama documentary. The letter, seen by Sky and NBC News, demands a retraction over the Panorama episode, which spliced two lines of Donald Trump's January the 6th speech together. A BBC spokesman is reported to have told NBC News, "We'll review the letter and respond directly in due course." Now, here's the BBC chairman, Samir Shah, being asked about it all on the BBC.
We have received communication from President Trump and his people, and we are at moment considering how to reply to him. He's a litigious fellow, so we should be prepared for all outcomes.
Samir Shah. Now, this morning, the outgoing chief executive of BBC News, Deborah Tennis, was questioned by a BBC reporter as she headed into Broadcasting House.
Deborah, have you failed the BBC?
I would like to say it has been the privilege of my career to serve as the CEO of BBC News and to work with our brilliant team of journalists. I stepped down over the weekend because the buck stops with me. I'd like to make one thing very clear. BBC News is not institutionally biased. That's why it's the world's most trusted news provider.
Deborah Turner's earlier. Now, the reform leader, Nigel Farage, has cast doubt over the funding model for the BBC.
We need a very much slimmed down BBC. When it comes to entertainment, when it comes to sport, and many other areas like that, well, they should compete against everybody else for a subscription model. That's the modern world that we live in. So the licence fee, as currently is, cannot survive. It is wholly unsustainable.
Nigel Farage there. Now, Alex Farber is the media correspondent for The Times, and he's here with me in the studio. Welcome to you, Alex.
Thanks, John.
So, what are your thoughts, then, on the BBC chairman's letter to these MPs and the way they've handled this thing so far?
Well, it